And I recently distanced myself and walked away from some consulting opportunities because I felt that it was an ethical dilemma for me, because I finally point in my career that I can't be silenced. I cannot check a box. I cannot look the other way. Financially, it's not always the most prudent thing for me to do, but I would rather stick with my values and my ethics and doing what's right. And it pains me to be in an organization where that's not happening.
That is Ann Richardson. She has over 20 years of experience in healthcare administration. She specializes in systems transformation and healthcare operations. In this episode, she recounts her experience in a large academic center. She emphasizes the value of setting boundaries and speaking up for safety and quality. She also talks about the importance of being clinically savvy in navigating the untouchables at work, even if they are senior leaders. Tune right in. Welcome to the Insightful Nurse Leader. This is a podcast by nurse leaders for nurse leaders. This show is focused on assisting leaders become effective managers and change facilitators. I'm your host, Miles Perilla. Join me every week as I speak with fellow nurse leaders, share insights, lessons learned, and practical advice. So, whether you're a seasoned frontline leader, a budding charge nurse, an experienced manager, or executive, you don't want to miss this. Well, welcome everyone to our 13th episode of the Insightful Nurse Leader. Today, our guest is Ann Richardson. Ann, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, Ann, I know you have a very interesting career and experience. You have worked a lot of years in the clinical side, although you're not necessarily clinical or involved with direct patient care. You have overseen operations of clinical departments on a 24/7 basis. Can you tell us more about how is that like?
So I have been an administrative director, executive director roles similar to that, leading operations for many hospital-based practices, largely in academic medical centers for the largest part of my career. I led anesthesiology in an academic medical center, OBGYN, but I've also been involved with primary care, multi-specialty ambulatory practices, and surgical services. So when I started off early in my career, I learned quickly that I needed to be as close to where the care was being provided so that I could learn of the opportunities and understand things like labor distribution and what I call the flows of medicine. I had to learn about capital equipment and so forth. So I also am a naturally inquisitive person, and I like to learn as much as I can about the clinical areas I'm in so that I can better advocate for the staff. And by advocating for the clinicians and staff, I'm actually advocating better for the patients, because no matter how interested I am in advocating for the patients, I can never provide that care for them.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. So, Ann, you're often referred to as a doctor whisperer. Can you tell us more about that?
So that started years back. It's interesting. The first person that was actually a IT person in a hospital, and subsequent to that, it's come up several times. And that is, there were often doctors, I'll say doctors in particular, that were resistant to change, whether it was a feature on electronic medical record and so forth, a wide variety of things, whether it was how we were going to staff a clinic, OR schedules. I became known as a person who had a way with what would be considered difficult positions, let's say. And people would say, oh, you're never going to get that doctor to do that, or whatever the case may be. And I loved that challenge, and I would always come out successful. And they'd say, how did you do it? And I'd say, well, simple. I just listened to them, and I let them define what's value added to them. I understood them personally in their practice. And once I understood, they gained a respect and an engagement with me that was necessary in order for me to even propose doing something different. And I also believe strongly, we don't tell people what to do. We might talk about how a change can add value, and we might demonstrate it, or we demonstrate it by showing how that change adds value. But nonetheless, it went so far as to, I've been in organizations that had, again, labeled very difficult surgeons, let's say, or doctors. And they'd say, even if it was out of my clinical area that I was overseeing, they would assign them to me to direct if they were employed because, oh, she can handle them. And I gladly took them on because I didn't like the fact that they were labeled number one. And I usually would find out that some are more vocal than others, and they were vocal, which is why they were labeled. And it's because nobody listened to them. And so if you just listen to them, ask them right questions, respect them, it could take 5 minutes. You could take a really difficult situation and just ask the right questions and listen. So I became known as the Dr. Whisperer for that reason. And I'm proud of it because it's, to me, it's pretty simple, but it works.
So what are the common problems that physicians or providers come to you for advice?
Well, in today's environment in healthcare, and again, as a person on the inside, when I was in an employed leadership role, my physicians and providers, nurses were all employed as well. And so what's happened over the years, and as I'd say it's gotten a lot worse today, is there's a lot of silencing that goes on. And people, depending on the leadership at the executive level, are often afraid to speak up, even physicians who are high volume surgeons, whatever the case may be. They often have been punished, if you will, labeled for speaking up too much. So my role has always been, and actually most organizations structure it this way, but you have a dyad model where you have a physician leader with an administrative leader, or at one time there was actually a triad, which was a nurse leader, a physician leader, and an administrator. So I was always that go-to person. And that just makes sense because they need somebody that can facilitate whatever that request is and whatever that change. But I also became a trusted, respected member of their team. So they could come to me for things that maybe somebody wouldn't go to one of my colleagues because they set up a structure where that really wasn't open. Whereas I tend to be what I call not an armchair manager. I'm very embedded near where the care is provided. So I'm always visible. I'm always accessible. So they would come to me for everything. And it was healthy though, because there were amazing number of things that they would come to me for that I was able to advocate and troubleshoot for them. And making it easier for the care team and supporting them means that the patient is getting better care in my mind.
Awesome. Did you find any barrier, if any, given that not having the necessary clinical background when you're dealing with issues in your area of responsibility, whether with the providers or the nurses?
No, because I embedded myself pretty close. If I happened to be overseeing an area that I didn't know clinically, I would learn as much as I could and ask a lot of questions. But I also knew what I knew and knew what I didn't know. So if something came up to me, any clinician that knows me, I would never put a patient at risk and instruct a nurse to do something that would put them or their team at risk. Same thing with a physician. So that really was never a challenge. And I'm clinically savvy enough that I would even get into debates with people where they would say, you must be a nurse. I'm not. Trust me, I'm not a nurse. So I was pretty good at it, but I don't fake it because I really want to know. And I really want to be able to support the patient as best as I can by giving them the resources. And sometimes you're a nurse, so you could probably relate to this statement. Sometimes people are so close to the care of the patient that outside pair of eyes will come in and provide something that kind of is quasi-clinical in nature about, why don't we try this? I don't mean treatment, but in terms of the process and the flow and how we might navigate a patient. I love that because they knew I understood, the clinical pathways of how we would typically navigate a patient, if you will, like say an oncology and surgical patients, for example.
Mm-hmm. That's very insightful. In my experience, that's very valuable. Even when I was working with a few management consulting firms, some of the consultants partnered with me were actually engineers, or not even clinical. But I was able to bounce off ideas with them, and they didn't have the cognitive bias, so to speak, that most clinicians have in their area of responsibility, which pretty much you're speaking to about that. So thank you for sharing that. So, Anne, earlier you mentioned about speaking up and some are almost like being punished for speaking up. What are the common themes that you notice as previously an administrator in organizations that are really sensitive in nature?
In my case, I would always advocate for the patients by advocating for the team. And the way I always put it is this, is that my philosophy is my job is to keep my finger on the pulse of the care team. And I say care team, but that's everybody. That's doctors, NPs, PAs, nurses, the whole team, the administrative support. And by keeping my finger on the pulse on them, and that means making sure that they're well, that they have the support that they need, that they can do their job. What are the resources that they need? by keeping my finger on the pulse of a team, they're better able to keep their finger on the pulse of the patient, right? But sometimes over the course of my career, when I would have to speak up and I would always be sometimes sheepish about this, I'd be sheepish about approaching, and I'd be very appropriate behind closed doors, you know, a new chain of command to talk about something that I was concerned about. A lot of organizations over the years, but in today, it's very, very prevalent from nurses and doctors that I talk to, that if you speak up on patient safety, if you speak up on safety in general, let's say our quality, especially as a non-clinician, I was criticized for that. I've been told over the years, why do you care so much? You're not a clinician. Go home. Have a glass of wine. Forget about it. I've been told, you're not a clinician. Why do you care so much for the nurses? Why do you advocate for the doctors? Some really incredulous things. And these were things that were said to me earlier in my career in leadership. And I found that it never got better. The only difference was I found that my voice became silenced, because as the years went on and I would speak up, I would find that the punitive damages, if you will, back to somebody like me seemed to get worse over the years. You know, there was a time where you could speak up on these things. And even though they may not have listened to you, but you could, I don't want to say get away, but you can almost get away with raising these issues and be okay. Whereas today, it seems to be much, much more punitive in nature. So this is the sick dog who's now coming to life and deciding to bark.
Yeah, no worries.
So I'm finding that silencing is a trend, I want to say, in healthcare in a lot of organizations. If you have top down management and you have a CEO, which as some people have described to me and I've written about it, that has the bully pulpit, that when I often will say that if the only audible voice in an organization is the CEO, then you're in trouble. That means even the leadership team below the CEO doesn't have a voice. Physicians don't have a voice, nurses don't have a voice, and so forth. That, to me, that's dangerous medicine. Because when your business, your core business is taking care of patients, everybody should have a voice, a respectful voice. And respectful, you know, dissent is, you know, is important. But at the same time, when it comes to patient safety and quality, we should be able to have a forum to speak up.
You know, what you had mentioned is actually more common in, even in my experience, there's a lot of that happening. I mean, just to, you know, be truthful about that, there's actually a lot of that in many organizations in, you know, one form or another. In your experience and that high level of a role in a hospital, what strategies have you found effective in navigating being able to speak up when you have to speak up for integrity and for patient safety, and yet not alienate yourself with other colleagues?
It's a slippery slope. And as the years went on until recent years, my position was eliminated at the beginning of COVID in 2020, and your voice was not welcome at all. And there was, you know, a handful of people in senior leadership that were terrific. And some of them were physician leaders and others, and they were amazing. But then it was balanced by others who weren't. And what ends up happening is it's like, you know, you become that, you sit around a table, the boardroom table, and you feel uncomfortable because you're like on an island all alone because everyone else is quiet because they don't dare to speak up. And you often get people who in the privacy of, you know, an office, your office or theirs, will say, I totally agree with you, but there's always that but. And, you know, people want to protect their title, their compensation, their job. They're fearful of speaking up. And in fact, I had that conversation with a couple of nurse leaders when there was something going on that I questioned. And see, this is where your respect and engagement with physicians is key. Classic example, there was something that was going to happen that was very risky for a patient, very risky. And I spoke up and I said, why are we doing that? And a nurse in a particular area who was in a leadership role said, I know it's risky, but the CEO said for me to never question that doctor. And I said, come on. I said, you are a high quality nurse leader. I said, you know better. He said, I know. And I said, well, you know what? I'm going to call her, you know, surgeon, and I'm going to address it. And so I did in a respectful way. And she was in the operating room and she panicked and she said, what do you want me to do? Just tell me what to do. And she really meant it. I said, look, I'm not going to tell you what to do clinically. You're a surgeon, but I am going to tell you that what you're trying to do is going to put the patient at risk. And what she was trying to do was take the patient from an inpatient bed, bring her to an ambulatory building to do a procedure, basically discharging her. But the patient's comorbidities put her at high risk for pulmonary embolism. And I thought that I said, you know, if she comes into the ambulatory building and we have a 911 situation, how do we explain to her family that we had to call 911, bring her to the ED, and then readmit her? Not to mention if there's any adverse, I said, this is crazy. I'm going to call radiology. Let's see if we can, you know, be able to do the procedure at the bedside. Bottom line is, if I didn't know what I knew clinically, because I'd learned, you know, that whole pathway, asked the right questions, got people on the phone, the bottom line is we got the patient the care that she needed at the bedside. A few hours later, it wasn't critical. And she was safe. But I reflect on that, because if that wasn't me questioning the authority and doing that wouldn't have been the case. Because in fact, the nurse who was navigating had already gone and taken the patient from the inpatient bed, who was a little bit confused. Why am I going to this building in a wheelchair? I saw her and I just politely said, bring her right back. But those are the kinds of things that happen every day. Because when you have a CEO who says, oh no, you know, cash is king and we need the RVUs and don't say no to this surgeon. Sometimes we put patients at risk and I'm not willing to do that. So even though I'm not a clinician, I tell you that story because even the surgeon was grateful for me speaking up. And she said, okay, she trusted me. And so we did right by the patient, but not everybody is as clinically savvy as me as a non-clinician. And to be honest with you, even the clinicians that I work with that should know better, they look the other way as well, often.
So thank you for being a fierce advocate for patient safety. As you were talking about that, there's one term that came to mind that I often hear, not often, but I would say I've heard in other organizations, and it's called the untouchables. You know, whoever they are in an organization, it's quite sad to hear that there are individuals in organizations that rules don't apply or we lower the standards in that regard. So on that note, do you have any strategies in, because there, you know, most organizations right now have like safety huddles, right? You know, whatever time of a day. Are these things covered or discussed in safety huddles, or what are the limitations of safety huddles?
Well, so you can only discuss and huddle review, you know, if the data is collected or reported. And so as time has gone on, I mean, with COVID, let's face it, you know, this was a problem long before COVID, but people are just not necessarily reporting. I mean, you know, look at the repercussions when, you know, a nurse has an error in reporting. I mean, there's a lot of concern about people's license and liability, and with staffing being what it is and nurse ratios being what they are, people feel that it's not necessarily safe medicine in some organizations. And so people feel that the amount of occurrences of mistakes, medical errors, and safety concern are exponentially significantly higher than we are reporting. So, I mean, if that answers your question, I think it's safe to say that it's gone on for years. Like what I described to you, that didn't go to a safety huddle, not at all. But yet, some of the stuff that they reported a safety huddle can almost be punitive in nature. And, you know, you roll your eyes, it's important. But yet it's like, well, what about the other 10 things that we all just experienced, you know, this morning or yesterday, right? And I also, you know, have worked in organizations where the CMO / quality physician, they're very politically aligned with the CEO as well. And they don't necessarily do the right thing.
Going back to the term untouchables, quote unquote, you know, it seems to me that they carry some sort of organizational power or influence, whatever their role is, whether it's tenure or position in the organization or influence to the board or what have you. What are the things that you could say from your experience that really help you become savvy as far as calling those things out or being able to, you know, put it in a way that it's, hey, focus on the patient safety, but being able to call things out as it is?
So for those, let's say, physicians that are deemed, because leadership also can be deemed untouchable too. For example, in fact, I wrote about it earlier today and I used that term untouchable. I don't know if you're aware of that, but when I was referring to two tenured professors who are academic chairs in a medical center that I worked in, and we all called them the untouchables. Why? Because they were powerful physicians and chairman positions, and they were also tenured. And so while they may lose their clinical chairmanship, they still are that tenured professor and they become the untouchables. But what I have learned in my own experience is I've worked with doctors who thought they were untouchable because of their volume, because with a fee-for-service environment, you know, revenue is king. And I've had doctors say to me, because their behavior was such that they were extremely disruptive, and I would counsel them and I'd say, you need to, you know, stop that, or you need to, you know, if you feel frustrated or something, come to me, we'll talk about it, but please don't use those words or say those things to the staff or to the CEO or whatever. And I've had doctors smile and laugh at me and say, oh, they can't touch me because my volume is so high. And every doctor that's ever said that to me has been fired. So even the untouchables can be fired, but here's the difference. They tend to be the employed surgeons and others, and they don't tend to be the untouchable like CEO, because that's another concern of many of us, is that where's the accountability for the CEO who maybe is looking the other way on, say, patient safety and quality, and or is a bully and is toxic, and you have a culture that is not psychologically safe. I'll argue that the buck stops with the board of directors who retains that CEO. But I found that those untouchables, in my personal experience, every untouchable position lost their job.
So from a nursing standpoint, have you had any incident where nursing leaders or in high-level positions confided with you and asked for help or assistance for advocacy? And how did you navigate that?
So one of the challenges that I've always seen, and it perplexed me early on, was the lack of leadership by a lot of chief nursing officers, who I found that some of the bad behavior and toxicity, not always, but often, came from CNOs. And when I meet and speak to nurses today, I ask them that question, and I haven't met a nurse yet that hasn't agreed with me. They have been challenged by that as well. And often I found them not to be the advocates for their nurses. And so if you're a nurse who would go to that CNO to talk about one of these concerns of safety and quality, they didn't feel that they were in a safe place to go to their own superior. But I've also worked with CNOs who were amazing people, but they were silenced from the CEO. So they were on a tough spot. And there was a lot of those little quiet, oh, I agree with you, but you know, I can't challenge the CEO. So that's a problem. And I've worked with organizations who don't, sadly, place high value on nurses, because when I've been in leadership roles, I was interviewing for a role and I asked who would be my nurse leader that I would partner with. And they said, oh, we don't subscribe to that model. We do the dyad, you know, and you and a physician work closely. I said, oh, I agree. But I said, to work and oversee and build a clinical program of this size, and we want to do all this community outreach, it would be important for me. And I didn't say this because I'm a non-clinician. I just know it from experience. I said, it would be important for me to have a strong nurse leader. No. And I was told, don't mention that to the CEO because he doesn't support that model. So I'm thinking, well, that's a problem when a hospital doesn't support a model where I would partner with a nurse. So, and the way that role ended up playing out, because I did get hired, you know, validated my concerns with the importance we place on people in key positions, namely nurses.
What does success look like for you?
So success to me would be enhancing or restoring the relationship between physicians and patients, okay? And where everybody has a voice, a respectful voice, where if we're talking about in hospital healthcare organizations, so if we're strictly focused on employed models of care, where more than 70% of the physicians in this country are employed, that we would be able to have a dignified, respectful structure where we have certainly a process, that it's not a free-for-all, but that physicians would be able to have their voices heard along with nurses, respiratory techs, administrators, and everybody else, that for the sake of advocating for our patients to provide safe, quality care. If you said that to somebody outside of healthcare, they'd say, well, isn't that the way it is? And I'd say, no, it's actually not. So it's not simple. I acknowledge the fact that in an organization, if it doesn't exist that way today, it's usually because of the top-down management. And if I, you know, were to draw a structure, of course, you'd have to have some executive leadership, but I would make it leaner with some of the C-suite positions and have more people who are actually connected to the front lines and where the care is provided, who are innovative, empathetic, compassionate servant leaders who can see the opportunities. And somebody like me, when I would see something, surgeons, anesthesiologists, you name it, they were never, ever offended if I brought up something and said, hey, you know, I saw an opportunity. They would just know that I was there so much that maybe I had a good idea and it was respectful. So I would want a better engagement and a leadership team that actually embraces the voice of everybody in the institution, but namely the clinicians.
What would you change in healthcare knowing what you know now?
I question, and I don't have the answer to this, I question why some people go into like senior leadership and executive leadership in hospitals, because when you see how they are as people and you get to know who they are at the core and you see how they lead, is it ego? Is it control? I'm not so sure, because somebody asked me recently about a particular leader. How did they get to that? How did they, you know, become that person? I said, that's who they are at the core, because some of these leaders that run healthcare organizations, they go from system to system and they take their little core team with them, whether it's a CFO, whatever the case may be. But I don't have the answer to why some of the people we have in leadership, how they get there and why, because it's painfully obvious to me that they're not a good fit. Because if we go back to the mission of, you know, a healthcare organization, a hospital, we should have people whose sole mission is to advocate and provide care for patients. So around improving access and providing a safe, quality environment. And the only way to do that is if we take care of the care team. Because if we don't take care of the nurse or the doctor and everyone else, then we have what we have today, which is a sick healthcare system, because our providers, our care team are sick. They're morally injured, which leads to burnout, and they're more and more leaving the clinical medicine and leaving the bedside.
And can you share a setback in your career or in your profession and share about how you overcame that situation?
So I had some experiences in healthcare where I suffered some abuses, and I honestly was silenced because I didn't dare to speak up and report various abuses because I didn't want to lose my job. And so I became, it wasn't in retrospect the healthiest thing to do, but it's what I did at the time. I carried those pains and suffering in silencing for years and years and years. And I became, I don't even want to use the word resilient, but I came kind of a cynic to the point that if I was in an organization and I saw some sort of behavior, I became not immune to it, but almost like, well, that's how it is everywhere. It was kind of an expectation. So if I actually came across excellence and I came across an empathetic, kind leader, it was a gift. But the baseline and the expectation of a standard was so low that because of the experiences I had, that if I came across something that was a pleasant surprise, like I said, I celebrated it like a gift. The bar was always, always low. So I walked away from healthcare after being in an academic medical center for about 11 years, and it was pretty abusive and toxic. And I took a break for about 5 years and used my MBA and my operations and my finance skills to do something else. And then I went back after 5 years because I actually missed healthcare. And when reentry was painful, it was actually worse coming back than when I left. And each time I go into an organization, because I've done some consulting, and I think that it's easier because you're not a W-2 employee. And as an interim leader or consultant, you don't have the full ownership. But somebody like me, who's such an advocate, I got deeply, deeply invested in the care teams and the patients and the access. And I recently distanced myself and walked away from some consulting opportunities because I felt that it was an ethical dilemma for me. Because I finally point in my career that I can't be silenced. I cannot check a box. I cannot look the other way. Financially, it's not always the most prudent thing for me to do, but I would rather stick with my values and my ethics and doing what's right. And it pains me to be in an organization where that's not happening.
Well, that's very admirable of you. Thanks for sharing that. So we talked a lot about maintaining integrity, choosing yourself, choosing the right thing to do. Now, looking at, you know, the bigger picture, right, I'm pretty sure there are other leaders out there, whether nurses, physician leaders, who are experiencing something similar to what you have shared. My question to you is, when should you leave your current position, even after being able to address things and, you know, to no avail? When is the right time to leave a position?
Well, again, we talk about the moral injury, because when you look at the words that, you know, describe what are the feelings of somebody that's morally injured. So if you're in a position where you're silenced and you see that patients are being harmed potentially, or staff is being harmed, you feel a sense of guilt because you're not providing the level of care that you know that you should be providing, or that maybe you provided a year ago or 2 years ago. You have a sense of grief because you feel like there's been more loss, and you feel anger and you feel tired. Those are the people that are leaving healthcare today. And it's not just the clinicians, it's people like myself, because I've been morally injured, because I've been, you know, in deep pain to see some of the losses that we've had, where my voice wasn't embraced and people didn't listen to me when it came to patient quality and safety. I've been the victim of people saying to me, "And the patients don't know the difference. They're lucky we're getting access to this care." And what they were alluding to was a demographic of patients that maybe were not affluent, or they weren't educated, and they were lucky that they were getting this level of care. So yes, they had complications, but they're not going to question it. So what do we do over time? We may choose to do something else with our experience, but we don't want to be a W-2 employee for those organizations, and we're selective with who we will work with. I'm finding that I meet with and speak to nurses and physicians on a daily basis, and many of them are pursuing other opportunities where they can use their clinical background and expertise outside of a clinical setting, because the opportunities are vast for clinicians today, whether you're a pharmacist, a respiratory therapist, a tech, and for administration as well. So people know when it's time, but like myself, I've been through things before where I just had to take a break and not pursue another opportunity because I needed that time to heal. And I'm speaking with a lot of people today that are going through that. And so I'll end this topic by saying this. Like in any relationship, when people are fighting to be heard and they want to resolve the relationship, a marriage, whatever the case may be, I say to people, when the voices stop and there's no more fighting, you know that people have an exit strategy. And there's a lot of people right now who are in a place, they have an exit strategy, and they're done going to their manager or the director, or that nobody goes to HR because very few people trust HR. And that's sad, but for good reason. So when people become quiet, that doesn't mean they're complicit. That means they're in deep pain more often than not. They're far from complicit, and they're only going to suck it up for so long before they will leave. And that's how their voice is heard, by with their feet when they walk out the door.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. That's very insightful. So, Anne, thank you for this awesome conversation. How can our listeners reach you?
So right now, the platform that I'm most active on is LinkedIn. I'm in the process of launching my website, and that should be imminent. And on LinkedIn, you'll find my email address, so people can email me or message me through LinkedIn or send a connection, and I'm happy to connect. Right now, most of the work that I'm doing is remote. I've been doing some advisory work for startup companies that need somebody like myself who's worked in a hospital environment, and people want to understand the finance and the operations. So I'm happy to do that type of work. But I also am helping nurses and physicians and other clinicians just to navigate the conundrum of the current state. And sometimes just having a voice like me who's walked the walk and who listens and sees them and gives them, you know, some hope and validation. Validation is very, very important.
Well, I really appreciate your time, and thank you for this very insightful conversation. And I hope our listeners will connect with you. Thank you for your time.
You as well.
Thank you for listening. To view the complete show notes and all the links mentioned in today's episode, visit milesperillaconsulting.com/podcast. And before you go, make sure you follow or subscribe to this podcast so you can receive the latest episodes as soon as they're released. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. Thank you again for joining me. This is your host, Miles Perilla, and you're listening to The Insightful Nurse Leader, I'll see you next time.